So can you give me, like, in 5 sentences or less, your faith journey? What led you to be the John Tucker who you are today?
This is Religion Better, Rabbi Brian's Talk with Clergy. Today, talking to John Tucker.
Okay. Raised Southern Baptist, fundamentalist. Uh-huh. Rejected that for philosophical atheism.
What age?
College. So college. 19. Came back to Christianity through liberation, feminist, black theologies.
Yeah.
And then the philosophy of Ludwig Wittgenstein helped bring me back to identifying myself as a religious person and as a Christian person. So there's the nutshell.
I'm glad you're joining me. I'm talking to John Tucker. He has a book out called Zero Theology. I think you're going to like this.
I appreciate it. Now, you said you said you were Southern Baptist and fundamentalist.
Yes.
To my ear, and you got to help this Jew boy out, those two, I didn't need to hear fundamentalist as soon as you said Southern Baptist. Am I wrong there?
Today you're not wrong. In the 1970s and early 80s, Southern Baptist Church was much more moderate than it is today.
Because I know about the Baptist Church, the American Baptist Church, the non-Southern one, and that's a whole different Baptist.
Right, and the Southern Baptist Church would have looked a little bit more like the American Baptist Church. I mean, I did not grow up fundamentalist. Oh, no. I would say we grew up. I probably grew up naive literalists, which is a distinction from fundamentalist, I think. But the fundamentalist takeover of the Southern Baptist Church in 1979, 1980 kind of started this whole wave.
It was a thing?
Yeah.
It was like there was a date and it changed?
Yeah, yeah. They took over the seminaries and changed the entire culture of what it meant to be Baptist.
Like, why is there not a movie documentary about this?
I don't know. I don't know who would watch it, but it's...
So apparently, 1979 summer, evangelist Billy Graham came to the Southern Baptist movement, and then this was covered by Phil Donahue and Nightline, and this was a huge thing in the late 1970s I didn't know a thing about.
Well, and I've never heard this point argued, but it seems interesting to me that it happened the exact same time that, especially in the South, where Democrats flipped to Ronald Reagan, and during that same window of time. My parents probably voted for Jimmy Carter in 1976 and Ronald Reagan in 1980.
A little history. 1638 in the United States, Roger Williams establishes the Baptist to be without creed. The Baptists were phenomenally liberal, which is why they hosted the first synagogue in the United States. The Baptists were the liberals of the religious world back then.
So help me out with what denomination would you put yourself in now?
So now I'm a United Methodist. I'm actually a district superintendent in the United Methodist Church.
Methodists tend to be socially liberal and open about their theology. That means you don't have to believe a certain thing or you're kicked out of the group.
And of course, the Methodist Church right now is going through the same thing the Baptist Church went through in 1980. We're about to split, kind of a fundamentalist.
And the Methodist Church is going more to the right?
Well, it depends on how, that's a complicated conversation, but yes, at our last general conference, the vote was to go to the right. Yes.
That was to, and we know that by saying same-sex marriage is bad, bad, bad.
Right. Yeah. That was the issue that prompted the, yeah.
Now you made a point in your book that heterosexual infidelity is probably a greater sin than homosexual monogamy.
To those who are coming from that viewpoint, I don't believe that, but yes.
No,
let's be very clear. I'm very progressive.
You are pointing that out, but how do people, I mean, so you've brought that point up to people. You're like, all right, so you say this and then you show it straight to them. Like, mm-hmm. That doesn't jive, dude. What's the response to your?
Well, I mean, I wish I had this conversation with more people than I've had. We don't talk about this kind of stuff in this kind of way in our system. We typically just pick up that Bible verse and argue from that Bible verse. But the point I make in the book is that there's a whole different conceptual game that's being played So that for those, for the folks who are intolerant and unaccepting, they see heterosexual infidelity as simply a mistake that somebody made while trying to play the right game. And they would see that homosexual fidelity is the wrong move in the wrong game. And so,
so it's, can I say it this way, that there's a, you know, that any religion, any spiritual practice has got to have a hierarchy of morals.
They're not, it's the, and this comes from Wittgenstein in a very different arena, but it's the difference between making a mistake versus doing something just very wrong. So in the book, I talk about the difference between a student who misses a mistake, who makes a mistake on a math problem.
Right. I talk about that all. I taught math for a lot of years. I talk about it all the time. It's like, it wasn't a sin, you dropped the negative sign.
That's right. So it, so basically, I'm that's an analogy. So that they see somebody, one of their own, who's made a, who's had an affair and had violated their heterosexual marriage covenant, is like somebody who made a mistake on a math problem, and oh well, let's forgive them.
And the other person is smoking pot and letting the air out.
The other person's not even trying math. You know?
Okay.
So
okay.
Yeah. So.
Listen, we all prioritize rules. It's what we do. We don't call the police when someone splits an infinitive or ends a sentence with a preposition. I'm not in the business of defending fundamentalists, but let's think of it this way. You and I probably agree that someone who abuses a child has committed a larger crime than someone who's stolen a candy bar from a market. They think the same, but with homosexuality instead of candy from a market. Also, John's not saying this. I'm just trying to explain the fundamentalist ideals.
What's the most troubling in Christendom, if I can give you like the entire category? It could be Bible, it could be denomination, it could be anywhere, but where do you think we're making the what's the largest misconception that you'd like to, if you could just take a pencil and edit that one and be like, no, we're getting that one all wrong. What's the thing that we're all getting all so wrong?
Well, you probably can predict it. Yeah, I would say that it's Christianity. For Christianity, it's the notion that there, an assumption that the that religious belief is more sensible than I think it actually is, and the assumption that being religious is fundamentally about holding certain kinds of beliefs.
Religion is not synonymous with holding certain beliefs.
Well, I think what I've changed is through what I kind of say in the book is trying to get people to think differently, to think, to escape what I call the correspondence theory of truth's belief paradigm, and to think differently about what religious language might be doing.
I think a lot, so you talk about the catch 22, and I know from Jung and others, so they talk about the paradox.
Right.
That's really the easiest way to understand religion is to understand it's not either or, it's a both and.
Mm-hmm.
So can you give a catch 22?
Well, sure. And I'll say this too, is that, so the reason that I went with catch 22s is because it's not immediately obvious what it means to believe or reject them. So that's automatically putting the brakes on what our culture wants us to do, which is take an opinion right off the bat about whether you believe it or not.
And I think you're completely right. People have this is my belief. Don't confuse me with the fact.
Right. That's right. That's right. So, I mean, one of the ones in the book, and I have 10 in the book, but one of them is that the only God that satisfies is the God that does not satisfy. And so...
Can I just say yum, yummy?
Sure. Tell me what does that mean for you? What is that?
That's just yummy. I had heard it in different words. It said God is just beyond the grasp of our comprehension.
Right.
It's a similar that. So the only God that's satisfied is the one that doesn't satisfy. That's yummy.
Yeah. I mean, because, and I think that most religious people demand satisfaction from their God, and that's why we lapse into idolatry, fundamentalism. You know, just a variety of religious illnesses, I suppose.
Yeah.
Due to poor editing, we're going to jump into a story of mine in the middle.
And she said, Brian, I don't understand. How can you be so scholarly and literate and still not believe Jesus is the true God? And I'm glad you're laughing.
Because it just seems, I know. Well, I know exactly the mindset that you're talking about there. It just seems so self-evidently obvious to these folks.
And I said, and I didn't know, like, I haven't, it's like playing chess. And I saw one of your book reviewers talked about playing chess. So,
right. Yes.
It's like I didn't know what the right moves for me were to say back to. So I said, Meister Eckhart, who said, Jesus Christ is the only true God, and so am I, and so are you.
Right. Yeah.
And I was like, well, you can check off the box, because I said Jesus Christ is the only true God. Yeah. I just had to add in the other two parts.
Yeah, that's probably where it became problematic for that.
It was not a good chess move. The chess game was sloppy.
Well, I think I'm reacting against a lot of that in my own life, but it's an assumption that being religious, or in my context, being Christian, is just perfectly reasonable. And I find that to be almost anti-religious. I would rather us admit that much of what Jesus had to say is beyond reason. In fact, it works against what we think of as reasonable, and I'd rather just let it be.
This silence is brought to you by Emphasis. Oh my God, I love what he just said. I wanted to sit in silence for a moment.
I'd rather let it be radical rather than try to tame it and make it fit.
People sure like it to be pablum. They like it and digestible, and amazing how many knots they'll put themselves in.
Right. Absolutely. And the way many people in our churches view parables, the parables of Jesus, is this idea that he's taking complicated thoughts and making them simple, which is exactly not what parables are about at all. They're closer to this paradoxical thing that we've already been talking about. It's meant to kind of throw you off balance. But it's this.
What do you make of Jesus's parable? It was the fig tree.
Mark 11:12-25. The next day, as they were leaving Bethany, Jesus was hungry. Seeing in the distance a fig tree in leaf, he went out to find if it had any fruit. When he reached it, he found nothing but leaves, because it was not the season for figs. Then he said to the tree, "May no one ever eat from your fruit again." And his disciples heard him say it. Skip a few verses. When evening came, Jesus and his disciples went out of the city. In the morning, as they went along, they saw the fig tree withered from its roots. Peter remembered and said to Jesus, "Rabbi, look, the fig tree you have cursed has withered." What?
Yeah. I know that my Southern Baptist roots frequently said that was a condemnation of Judaism. I mean, you had to have run across that.
Yeah, but it doesn't say that.
No, it doesn't. But I mean, I'm just telling you this how it's...
Yeah, it's amazing.
Misinterpreted or...
I think what I'm coming to in all this is whoever controls the media controls the message. What's something people just don't know about the Bible, about denominations, about religion in general, that you'd be like, I want to get on my little soapbox and I want to tell everyone this?
I guess I would want to say that people assume that those of us who live after the Enlightenment think in the same kinds of ways that people did before the Enlightenment. And so that if I believe something today, it means the exact same thing that Peter believed back in the New Testament.
Give me an example. I need a little bit.
Well, more. I mean, I think we assume retroactively reinterpret projecting our own ways of thinking back on ancient peoples, and we believe
right.
They hold a propositional based faith, which I don't think they do. I don't think it has anything to do with it. But we have a propositional based faith because we're post Enlightenment.
Right, because we have Greek logic in a real way.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah.
Strong way. And they were much more associative logic. And we're enlightened, you and me. Why are people still holding to false gods?
Well, are you asking why are people still? Well, because I mean, that seems to be the easiest course for human beings to take, isn't it? It's the path of least resistance. Give me.
I think you're absolutely right. I just want to throw up.
Yeah. Oh yeah. Oh yes. Absolutely. So yeah. So being religious, I think, is a rare thing.
And this is an awful question, so I'll stall after I ask it. How would you define religious?
A commitment to continually identifying sources of denial and rooting them out of your life while being committed to what I call transcendent love, courage, compassion.
So you have some good ethics. Well, give me the first half of it again. So being committed to love.
Fighting against all forms of denial with which we used to comfort ourselves. You know,
religious life is not to comfort yourself, but to let yourself into all of the discomfort.
Right. Yeah. But most of what we experience, and I mean, in our, at least what I see when I look around, is that religion has primarily been used to make people feel comfortable.
I'm going to restate that. That religion isn't about making yourself comfortable. It's a commitment to root out our denial while being committed to love, compassion, courage, and transcendence. Amen.
The whole phrase of that the religious person's job is to comfort the afflicted and to afflict the comfortable.
Right. Yes,
but we don't do a lot of afflicting the comfortable. And I have a good theory on that one.
Okay. Sure.
Well, the people who are paying the dues, the members.
Oh yeah, absolutely.
Mm-hmm. Are theologically often behind, the people who are preaching don't want to upset the people who are paying their.
Right. Yeah. And I actually do mention that as a part of the book where there's a fear, I think, from, you know, because one of the big things I make in the book is that we should be trying to confront what I call absolute grief, which is the possibility that life is meaningless and that, you know, all the worst case scenarios that people have. And that religion has come to mean let's avoid that confrontation at all possible costs. And I think, no, religion actually should be helping us to confront that possibility.
That's a beautiful statement, John.
Well, thank you. But religious leaders don't see that pays off. If you force people to confront the worst possible scenario, you're going to lose some of them to it.
Hey folks, we're all going to die.
That's right. Yeah. And the ones who do face it and overcome it with courage are not going to need the, what I call the weekly, grief immunizations that most of our churches give out on Sundays, which are just forms of denial. So, I mean, for a clergy person, it's like, where's the win in this? If I help people grow, they're likely to leave.
Right. Absolutely.
Yeah. But I've always kind of seen it as my job is to kind of help people graduate. I mean,
there's a great phrase, Alan Watts. I don't know if you know him. He said that the clergy person's job, he was an Anglican priest before he became a guru, or the not guru that he was. He said the clergy person's job is to be more like a physician. Where your job is to heal people and send them on their way.
Right. Yeah, absolutely. Yes. And of course, I have to continually work on myself too. But when I'm in a congregation, I've kind of, you know, as you get to know people, you can start assigning them almost like grade levels. You know, I've got, so if I see somebody who's like at the fifth grade level of their faith, it was my job as a clergy person to get them to the sixth grade.
Yeah.
If they were a senior, it was my job to help them graduate. So I couldn't give the same message to everybody because there are different levels of development. But it was always my job to try to get them to move one level up. You know.
Yeah, constantly.
So yeah.
Constantly. Well, your book, Zero Theology: Escaping Belief Through Catch-22s. People should buy that and read that.
Well, I've been very pleased with the results from people who have read it. I've had some interesting emails from some very different kinds of people. Daniel Dennett, one of the new atheists, has read it and likes it. And then people like Brian McLaren also. I mean, so it's been kind of cool. I live in both of those worlds, so it's great to see them kind of come together.
That's wonderful. I love.
All right, so we are wrapping up this conversation. I want to thank you for listening. Rabbi Brian talks with some clergy folk. This is great. If you have people you think I should talk to, would you do me a favor and reach out to them, reach out to me and connect us? And you got other people who you think should listen to this, please let them know as well. Religion Better. Rabbi Brian's Talk with Clergy. Thanks for listening.
I love what you're doing. That's why I reached out. And I was like,
well, thank you. And I appreciate what you're doing too. Since you reached out, I was kind of looking you up and see. Yeah. So you're doing some really good work. And
we're doing very similar things, but you grew up being told you were Southern Baptist. I grew up told I was Jewish. And
that's right.
I think we both come to a clearing in the woods going.
That's right. Yeah, that's right.
Because I don't think, I only know you from talking and reading some, but I don't think we have any different beliefs. And if we did, I don't think they would be of any consequence.
Right. Yeah, that's probably true. Which is, I mean, one of the main points of the book is that even though in that book I'm thinking in terms of theists and atheists, if we could just free them from this certain trap, this belief paradigm trap, they would discover that what they disagree about is actually not very.
It's very little.
So, yeah.
Good, good, good. I appreciate it. And also, if I can just add in one other thing is, I like how much you laugh. Thank you, brother.
Okay, thank you so much, Brian. I appreciate this opportunity.
Oh, I'm so glad to get to meet you. Thank you.
Also, you as well.
Bye-bye.